We live in the world, which is headed and run by the prince of the power of the air. But we live by the Spirit, discerning the times. For he who is spiritual discerns all things. Sharpen your discernment. Build your faith. Listen to the Word and World Team. Minister the Word of God through conversational theology, piercing the darkness of this present evil age.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
Welcome back. This is Hampton Keithley with Bob Brandon, and we are continuing our book review of Rodney Stark's How the West Won. How are you today, Bob?
I'm good, Hampton. Yourself?
Well, met my mother-in-law's. She got out of the hospital and came back home today, yesterday. So
nice.
Round the clock watch care and all of that going on. So I'm in San Antonio.
Oh, you're down there. Okay. Yeah. Well, great. Glad things are going well.
Yes. Yes. She's very weak, but, alert and walking with the walker with help. So.
Good. Good. Well, I'm excited about today, Hampton. We've got some more great material.
Yes. I like this chapter a lot.
Yeah. It'll help, continue to allow us to pierce the veil, right, of the social imaginary. the way we've been taught to look at history and how different the real history is from that. That's important for us. You know, I want to start out, as is our habit, reading the scripture. I want to set up this morning a little bit, and then I want to read some of Daniel again.
Okay.
So this is Proverbs chapter 25, and it's verse 2. But before we even read there, I want people to know that I've mentioned this a few times, but it'll really repay the study if our listeners dive into the structure of the scriptures. They're way more structured than people tend to realize. You know, with Proverbs, oh, I read one a day, and so on. And that's good. You should be doing that. But at the same time, you got to back up from the one a day proverb thing and see the structure of that. So chapters 25 through 27 of Proverbs were, I'll read verse 1 of chapter 25. These also are Proverbs of Solomon, which the men of King Hezekiah of Judah copied. So this is a separate section. It runs through chapter 27, written by Solomon, but compiled by Hezekiah much later down the line. And the subject has to do with kings, primarily. How should you run your country?
Okay.
How appropriate for our subject, right?
Right.
And so the first verse then in that collection goes, it is the glory of God to conceal a matter, and it's the glory of a king to search out a matter. So in other words, God has established creation and the principles of the creation, you know, the inherent order that fights off chaos and so on. And it's mankind's job, as particularly represented by the king, to discern God's handiwork. How did he do it? How do things work? How should things run? And so you could see verses like this forming, you know, a pillar of a Christian's worldview. And it's often been the case down through history that it's been Christians leading the way in the intellectual pursuit of the world, not as a thing of pride like I'm an intellectual and so on, but as a thing of how should you do it? How should you walk faithfully with God? How has he so ordered the world that we should walk in accordance with that order? That's been Christians doing that. It's been Christians making the great discoveries of science down through the ages. And then that's what we're going to read about today. So I just wanted to set up our time with that passage. Then I also wanted to read from Daniel, as is our habit, because as we walk down the halls of history, Daniel did the same thing, but we're walking, you know, looking backwards through Stark's book, How the West Won. But Daniel was walking through the halls of history looking forward. And you remember Nebuchadnezzar had his dream in Daniel chapter 2, and there were four kingdoms of man that were going to come upon the earth. Babylon was the head of gold, and then Medo-Persia, you know, was the next kingdom, then Greece, and then Rome. So this is Daniel chapter 8, and the rest of the prophetic material in the book of Daniel after chapter 2 is really explaining that statue. All those details. It's just giving more and more detail on the aspect of the statue. So here's Daniel chapter 8. In the third year of King Belshazzar's reign, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after the one that had appeared to me previously. In this vision, I saw myself in Susa, the citadel, which is located in the province of Elam. In the vision, I saw myself at the Ulai Canal. I looked up and saw a ram with two horns standing at the canal. Its two horns were both long, but one was longer than the other. The longer one was coming up after the shorter one. I saw that the ram was butting westward, northward, and southward. No animal was able to stand before it. There was none who could deliver from its power. It did as it pleased and acted arrogantly. While I was contemplating all this, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of all the land without touching the ground. This goat had a conspicuous horn between its eyes. It came to the two-horned ram that I had seen standing in beside the canal and rushed against it with raging strength. I saw it approaching the ram. It went into a fit of rage against the ram and struck it and broke off its two horns. The ram had no ability to resist it. The goat hurled the ram to the ground and trampled it. No one could deliver the ram from its power. The male goat acted even more arrogantly, but no sooner had the large horn become strong than it was broken, and there arose four conspicuous horns in its place, extending towards the four winds of the sky. From one of them came a small horn, but it grew to be very big toward the south and the east and toward the beautiful land. It grew so big it reached the army of heaven, and it brought about the fall of some of the army, some of the stars, to the ground where it trampled them. It also acted arrogantly against the prince of the army, from whom the daily sacrifice was removed and whose sanctuary was thrown down. The army was given over, along with a daily sacrifice, in the course of his sinful rebellion. It hurled truth to the ground and enjoyed success. Then I heard a holy one speaking. Another holy one said to one who was speaking, "To what period of time does the vision pertain, this vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the destructive act of rebellion, and the giving over of both the sanctuary and army to be trampled?" And he said to me, "To 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary will be put right again." While I, Daniel, was watching the vision, I sought to understand it. Now one who appeared to be a man was standing before me. Then I heard a human voice coming from between the banks of the Ulai. And it called out, "Gabriel, enable this person to understand the vision." So he approached the place where I was standing. As he came, I felt terrified. and fell flat on the ground. Then he said to me, "Understand, son of man, that the vision pertains to the time of the end." And as he spoke with me, I fell into a trance with my face to the ground. But he touched me and stood me upright. Then he said, "I'm going to inform you about what will happen in the latter time of wrath, for the vision pertains to the appointed time of the end. The ram that you saw with the two horns stands for the kings of Media and Persia. The male goat is the king of Greece, and the large horn between its eyes is the first king. The horn that was broken, and in whose place there arose four others, stands for four kingdoms that will arise from this nation, though they will not have his strength. Toward the end of their rule, when rebellious acts are complete, a rash and deceitful king will arise. His power will be great, but it'll not be by his strength alone. He will cause terrible destruction. He'll be successful in what he undertakes. He'll destroy powerful people and the people of the holy ones. But his treachery will succeed through deceit. He will have an arrogant attitude. He'll destroy many who are unaware of his schemes. He'll rise up against the prince of princes, yet he'll be broken apart, but not by human agency. The vision of the evenings and mornings that was told to you is correct, but you should seal up the vision, for it refers to a time many days from now. I, Daniel, was exhausted and sick for days. Then I got up and again carried out the king's business, but I was astonished at the vision, and there was no one to explain it." What do you think of all that, Hampton?
Very confusing.
Oh, come on.
You going to explain it to me?
Well, that would take the whole
take the
time,
rest
right?
of the podcast. Yeah.
It would. I just want to lay out those prophetic passages before us. But I mean, it's clearly anyone who knows the history that Daniel's referring to prophetically, he's looking forward. We would be looking back. That's Persia, you know, Medo-Persia and right. Greece. I mean, it's as clear as a bell, you know, this big horn on the goat, you know, that really wanted to attack the ram. And that's how Alexander spent most of his short life, was fighting Persia. Mm-hmm. He annihilated them. And yeah. probably the greatest general ever, right? But he died as a very young, you know, 33. And on his deathbed, you know, there's a large concern because he doesn't have a male heir. Right. And they say, you know, he throws the world into chaos because they say, well, Alexander, to whom does the kingdom go? And he says, to the fittest. So like, you guys fight it out. And they did. And so, you know, the world was just in turmoil for 10, 20 years till, you know, four of his generals end up the dominant guys, Lysimachus, Cassander, Ptolemy, and Seleucus. And so they, you know, the text says they parcel it out to the four winds, right? So that then the main issue in the second half of that chapter is going to come from the Seleucid kingdom. And those kings, you know, were usually named Antiochus something, right? Mm-hmm. Antiochus the first, Antiochus the second. So the main one that gets focused upon in the second half of that chapter is Antiochus Epiphanes. You can recognize by his name, oh my gosh, Epiphany, you know, God, man, Antiochus, God manifest. So that's how he perceived himself and went on to attack the Jews.
Was he named that or did he name himself, I guess?
He took on that title, right? I don't think his mom called him that. But that was, you know, that's what the coins are going to be stamped. Antiochus Epiphanes and so on. So anyway, most of that material, the historical material that details all of that is found in the Apocrypha. So those are good books to read for their historical content. I mean, they're giving you accurate history.
Right.
They're not scripture, but they're telling you what went down. So you can read all about Antiochus in 1 and 2 Maccabees, stuff like that. But he is the picture, and the reason he gets focused upon is because he's what's called in biblical theology a type. So he's a very close representation of the Antichrist who will come. Right. So if you study Antiochus, you have a good idea of what to look for in the future. So
very good.
Okay, take us through Stark.
Yeah, well, we're going to do chapter 8, which is the pursuit of knowledge. And I always like reading his introduction because he lays it out so well. So I'm going to do that.
Yep.
The most fundamental key to the rise of Western civilization has been the dedication of so many of its most brilliant minds to the pursuit of knowledge, not to illumination, not to enlightenment, not to wisdom, but to knowledge. And the basis for this commitment to knowledge was the Christian commitment to theology. So when he's talking about not illumination and not enlightenment, something that would be heavy into that would be like Buddhism, right?
Yes.
More enlightened you are, the more you recognize you don't exist or whatever.
Yeah, but so, I want to emphasize something there. Think, you know, as we read that stuff so quickly, it needs to sink in. The most fundamental key to the rise of Western civilization. Pause there. Wouldn't that be a great thing to ask, like as a trivia question? You know, hey, what do you think caused the rise of the West in world history? And I doubt if very many people would answer that the way Stark has done it through his research. The answer is it's the pursuit of knowledge that caused the West to rise. And that came out of a Christian worldview.
Yes, so, it did. And I would say, though, that people, if, you know, what is their God or their the word science is what I'm trying to get to. But, you know, follow the science. Yeah. And really, science is the pursuit of knowledge.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. We've kind of got moved past science. We're post-science, if you will.
So. Well, remind me to bring something up as we close today.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So he goes on to say, theology is in disrepute among most intellectuals. The word is taken to mean a passe form of religious thinking that embraces irrationality and dogmatism. So too, scholasticism. According to most dictionaries, the word scholastic often means pedantic and dogmatic, denoting the sterility of medieval church scholarship. John Locke, the 18th century British philosopher, dismissed the scholastics as, quote, the great mint masters of useless terms meant to cover their ignorance. In the 20th century, Sir William Dampier spoke for most conventional academics when he complained that scientific thought was quite foreign to the prevailing mental outlook of the scholastics, who were enmeshed in a tangle of astrology, alchemy, magic, and theosophy, and were absolutely hostile to experimentalism. Not so, he says, the scholastics were fine scholars who founded Europe's great universities, formulated and taught the experimental method, and launched Western science. So that's several different historians that are basically lying about what was going on in the Middle Ages.
Don't you love it when he says, not so?
Right.
So whenever you hear that, adjust your social imaginary, right?
Right.
Okay.
As for theology, it has little in common with most religious thinking, being a sophisticated, highly rational discipline that has its roots in Judaism and in Greek philosophy, but is fully developed only in Christianity. The pursuit of knowledge was inherent in theology, as efforts to more fully understand God were extended to include God's creation, thus inaugurating an academic enterprise known as natural philosophy, defined as the study of nature and of natural phenomena. During medieval times, a long line of brilliant scholastic natural philosophers advanced Western knowledge in ways leading directly to the Copernican revolution, and he has revolution in quotes, and the extraordinary scientific achievements of the 16th and 17th centuries.
Yeah, very good.
Any comments?
Well, just that, you know, one of my favorite illustrations is, say you're looking at a picture painted by Leonardo. I mean, he didn't do that many pictures that we have, mm-hmm. you know, in existence, maybe 12, 13, something like that. But when you look at one of those paintings and actually study it, you can almost begin to see Leonardo himself. You know, you can like understand him a little bit, right? And then you can research his life, and it makes the paintings so much more valuable. And so it is with God's handiwork. As you look at the creation and dive into it intellectually, you know, the natural sciences, biology, chemistry, physics, and so on, you can see a little bit of God in that. And then as you read the Bible, it just makes it, I don't want to say come alive, because it's already alive,
right.
But it makes you realize how alive it is. So that's what these guys were fundamentally doing. That was their worldview that motivated their pursuit of research. It's a fantastic period of history.
It is. So he goes on to say, sometimes, and I think this is a really important section, because it talks about, you know, why this happened only in the Christian
yeah.
world.
Yep. Yep.
Sometimes described as the science of faith, theology consists of formal reasoning about God. The emphasis is on discovering God's nature, intentions, and demands, and on understanding how these define the relationship between human beings and God. Theology necessitates an image of God, one God, not many gods, as a conscious, rational, supernatural being of unlimited power and scope. That is why there are no theologians in the East. Those who might otherwise take up such an intellectual pursuit reject this first premise of theology. Consider Taoism. The Tao is conceived of as a supernatural essence, an underlying mystical force or principle governing life, but one that is impersonal, remote, lacking consciousness, and definitely not a being. It is the eternal way, the cosmic force that produces harmony and balance. According to the ancient Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu, the Tao is always non-existent, yet always existent, unnameable, and the name that can be named, both soul, soundless and formless, and always without desires. One might meditate forever on such an essence, but it offers little to reason about. The same applies to Buddhism and Confucianism. Although the popular versions of these faiths are polytheistic and involve an immense array of small gods, as is true of popular Taoism, the pure forms of these faiths are pursued by the intellectual elite, are godless, and postulate only a vague divine essence. Buddha specifically denied the existence of a conscious God. And in the words of the scholar Bradley Clow, Buddhists have even gone so far as to say that belief in such a God often leads to ethical degradation.
Well, there you go. Well said.
Yeah. And then he goes, but even the first premise of a conscious, all-powerful God is not enough to sustain theology. It's also necessary to think it is legitimate to apply human reason to questions about God. That is why there are no Muslim theologians. Just as Muslim clerics have rejected science as heretical because they believe that natural laws imply limits on Allah's freedom to act, so too do they deny the legitimacy of relying on reason to expand their understanding of Allah. All that needs to be understood about Allah is written in the Quran. The proper role for Muslim thinkers is to interpret scripture, that is, to ensure that the people follow Allah's commands. So I thought those are good explanations of, you know, why you don't have science in the East. And yeah, going back to my Kevin Costner Robin Hood movie where, you know, the Muslim guy gives the telescope to Robin Hood. And we learned in the last chapter about, or maybe it's this chapter, I'm losing my place, but where telescopes and all that really came from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good, a good explanation of the fundamental reasons for things, right? And then, so if you think, jump outside of this just for a second, and then try to apply it to the world around us today, Western thought has lost the concept of God for the powers that be, right? The average citizen may well have that, but not the powers that be. They believe we evolved. So why not put your hand into that and adjust it the way you see fit?
Then that's why we've lost the ability to reason.
That's right.
That's one of my favorite quotes from Chesterton is, they tried to pull the mitre off of pontifical man, and his head came off with it.
Well, there you go.
Okay. In contrast, Christian theologians have devoted centuries to reasoning about God's nature and about the very meaning of God's teachings. Over time, some theological interpretations have evolved dramatically. For example, although the Bible does not condemn astrology, and the story of the wise men following the star might even seem to suggest that it is valid, in the 5th century, St. Augustine reasoned that astrology is sinful because to believe that one's fate is predestined in the stars stands in opposition to God's gift of free will. So, and he goes on to quote Tertullian, and he's, you know, basically saying that, you know, we need to use reason and not just blind faith, like kind of summarizing his quote. But
sure.
So anyway, that's why science came from Christianity and not the other religions.
Yeah. And think back to when we went over the Hebrew words for wisdom. Well, mm-hmm. Why are there so many of those? You know, that's mankind's, that's looking from the ground up,
right?
You know, that's mankind taking God's revelation that he's given them and then looking back up into heaven and trying to figure stuff out. So they have numerous words for wisdom and the skill in doing, applying knowledge and so on, and how to walk faithfully. You know, that it's such a false dichotomy to think of that there's Christian theology on one hand, and then on the other hand, there's science, as if those things were separate, that there was a great wall between them. It's the opposite. Mm-hmm. Most of the great scientists in history up until this point in history have been Christians.
Right.
So,
well, he concludes that section saying it would be difficult to exaggerate the importance of the bond between theology and natural philosophy for the rise of Western civilization. As a result of this bond, the pursuit of knowledge about the natural world became central to the medieval university curriculum and led ultimately to the rise of Western science.
Well, he said it way better than I did.
Yeah. So he goes on and starts talking about the invention of universities. Perhaps in difference to the political correctness of our times, or perhaps because of ignorance, there have been many recent efforts to place the first universities in China or India or Persia. Of course, many of the ancient empires had schools devoted to teaching religious culture, as well as institutions that sheltered those devoted to contemplation and meditation. But there, just as there are no theologians in the East, none of these ancient institutions was devoted to the pursuit of knowledge. Rather, as the prolific Harvard scholar Charles Homer Haskins put it, universities, like cathedrals and parliaments, are the product of the Middle Ages. More specifically, they were the product of the medieval church. So,
yeah.
University sprang up in the not so dark ages, as he called them.
Yeah, that's right. And then there's some great trivia material. So let me put it out there before we actually read it. I
Okay.
wonder if people know what was the very first university established. I certainly would not have known this, right? Till I read Stark. But it's Bologna in northern Italy.
That's not
Se
baloney.
I know what a possible pun you got there. Oh my gosh. So and then University of
In
Paris.
1088, just
Yep.
after the Norman invasion.
Yeah, then Paris, University of Paris. Yeah, after the Norman invasion, remember we talked about the Vikings and the skewed picture that, the false imaginary that we all have in our mind, these guys with horns coming out of their helmets and big furry vests,
Right.
right? They brought culture with them. They established Western culture as far as a people group. So they established these universities. How you would not have assumed that connection between Vikings and universities.
Right. That's he pointed out that they basically came to the conclusion that it was the human's soul that made him unique and not his body. And that because of that freed him up to start dissecting humans and learning about what made us tick.
Yeah, this is only a minor rabbit trail because I know you're longing to do that to me. But again, if you study Leonardo, boy, he spent a lot of time dissecting human bodies. And some of his medical work in that regard is really unsurpassed even today. His diagrams of human anatomy. And imagine he's doing that in the dead of night because there were those Stark is saying here that okay, they accepted the procedure of doing that, but not everywhere.
Right.
And he could have easily been labeled a criminal and thrown into jail for grabbing human bodies off the gallows or wherever he could find them and dissecting them. But his work's amazing.
Towards the end of that section, there's a quote that says, as William of Auvergne, this is 1180 to 1249, a professor of theology at the University of Paris put it, "Let it not enter your mind that I want to use the words of Aristotle as authoritative for the proof of things I am about to say, for I know that a proof from an authority is only dialectical and can only produce belief. Though it is my aim, both in this treatise and wherever, whenever I can, to produce demonstrative certitude." End quote. So even better was to have discovered something unknown to the classical world. So much then,
Yes.
Stark says, for the claims that the scholastic merely incited dogma or debated theological minutiae. I just love how
Yeah.
he comes up with these things to, like you say, shoot holes in the social imaginary.
Well, that's right. And so, in other words, what they were in the process of establishing was a scientific method. His point was, I'm not all about just quoting Aristotle. That doesn't prove anything to
Right.
him, right? He wants physical experiments, repeatable, so that you can understand the processes of things. Then, of course, that's applicable to the material realm. Once you get past the material realm, then you are into more Aristotle and stuff like that. But they were in the process of establishing the scientific method, and what they were after was proof and understanding, but all
Right.
of that came from a Christian worldview.
His next section is the University of Paris. And he said that a lot of people think that universities, medieval universities, were quite small, just a few masters and perhaps 100 students. But the University of Paris had like somewhere between 2,500 and 5,000 students and several hundred faculty. The average student was, 14 or 15. Then he tells about academic freedom, where that came from, and I thought that was interesting, where they had a the students got in a fight and had a riot. The police and the city officials wanted justice, and the university took up for the students and eventually went on strike for 2 years until the Pope comes along and says, okay, the university is its own thing and it polices its own people. And so that's, I guess, the original academic freedom.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was good that they did that. You can almost see that echoes of that today, Hampton. Like if you go back and look at your college campus, you know, mine has changed significantly. You can still, of course, recognize where you are, but it is expanded and beautified. And a lot of college campuses are that way. It's almost as if they're, you know, a power unto themselves. When you're picking a president for your school these days, you're not looking at an academic. Of course, they'll have degrees, but that's really just on paper. They're not professors that are leading schools. Those are developers, mm-hmm. right? Those are fundraisers and developers, and they build their own kingdoms. And man, they've done quite the job. There are a few college campuses today, at least in America, that you're not just overwhelmed with the beauty of the place.
Right. He talks about the curriculum, grammar, rhetoric, logic, not much theology. A lot of them went into medicine and law. And the faculty, he said, this was before the age of publish or perish.
Uh-huh.
It said that had not yet come into vogue. Consequently, only dedicated scholars with something to say devoted time to the pursuit of new knowledge. And the world was spared the flood of trivia churned out by careerist faculty in modern times.
Well, there you go.
That's why we have so many books, I guess.
That's right.
And then his next section, Scholastics and the Copernican Revolution, and he always puts revolution in quotes. Just as there were no dark ages, there was no scientific revolution. Rather, the notion of a scientific revolution was invented to discredit the medieval church by claiming that science burst forth in full bloom, thus owing no debts to prior scholastic scholars, only when a weakened Christianity no longer could suppress it. But as will be seen in chapter 13, the great scientific achievements of the 16th and 17th centuries were produced by a group of scholars notable for their piety, who were based in Christian universities, and whose brilliant achievements built on an invaluable legacy of centuries of scholastic scholarship. The start of the so-called scientific revolution is usually attributed to Nicholas Copernicus, who lived in 1473 to 1543. According to the fashionable account, Copernicus was an obscure Catholic canon in far-off Poland, an isolated genius who somehow discovered that, contrary to what everyone believed, the earth revolves around the sun. Moreover, the story goes, the church made unrelenting efforts to suppress this view. There is far more fiction than fact in this account. Rather than being some obscure Pole, Copernicus received a superb education at the best Italian universities of the time, Bologna, Padua, Ferrara. The idea that the earth circles the sun did not come to him out of the blue. He learned the fundamentals leading to the heliocentric model of the solar system from his scholastic professors. What Copernicus added was not a leap, but the implicit next step in a long line of discovery stretching back centuries.
Yeah, that's so helpful to point that out. I'm going to do the same thing we did with this opening paragraph and just read it just a little more slowly, not the whole paragraph, but just as there were no dark ages, there was no scientific revolution. Rather, the notion of a scientific revolution was invented to discredit the medieval church, right? So that's how the social imaginary happens, right? You have motives generated by false worldviews, and they'd like to obscure the past. But the real truth is those guys, the scholastics, were headed in that direction anyway, as far as the heliocentric model. So. He did a great job.
I just had a thought about the Enlightenment, and I go back to what Stark said at the beginning of this chapter, that it wasn't about Enlightenment. You know, it was about theology.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
which, you know, if you're going to read, you know, one of our favorite human authors of the Bible, John, he's going to talk about the light a lot. Mm-hmm. But what they meant by enlightenment was to discredit the quote dark ages, which weren't dark at all.
Right.
So they were trying to draw that contrast. But
so what he does next is he just runs through a bunch, about a dozen, maybe more,
scholars. Guys. Yeah.
Scholars. And these guys are pretty much all theologians and bishops and all that. And so I just want to kind of like give their name and their date and then maybe tell what they did. So Robert Grosseteste. So in German, that would be big or a lot of tests. It's ironic because what he's famous for. Oh, and he lived from 1175 to 1253. And what he's famous for says, but perhaps his most important contributions involved what has become to be called the scientific method. And so he was the one, you know, one of the first ones to really do tests and
repeatable experiments and so on.
Yeah, he was doing experiments. And so the emphasis on observation was the basis for all science.
Yeah.
And he kind of started that. John of Sacrobosco, 1195 to 1256. Said, although little is known about him, he wrote two influential books, both of which survive. The first was Algorithmus, which introduced the Hindu-Arabic numerals and new methods of numerical calculation for the first time to the European universities. And he, you know, there's a lot of stuff loaded in that word Hindu-Arabic numerals.
Mm-hmm.
But then another book of his, right, or maybe it's later in this book, but he'll say something about the Hindus were actually the mathematicians that the Muslims had conquered.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of weird that they call them Arabic numbers because it's not Arabic.
Yeah.
The second book this guy wrote was Tractatus de Sphaera, usually referred to as Sphere, was a readable astronomy textbook based on Ptolemy's cosmology. The title reflects the claim that the earth and all the heavenly bodies are spherical. Sphere was required reading for European university students for the next several centuries, often praised for its clarity. Albertus Magnus, 1200 to 1280. He was the author of, he was the bishop of Regensburg, but he was the author of 38 books. And he was so celebrated during his lifetime that his colleagues, including Roger Bacon, added the title Magnus, or the Great, to his name. And he was regarded as one of the theological giants of medieval times, but he also put to empirical testing claims that Aristotle and other classical Greek philosophers had made about nature. In doing so, he became perhaps the best field botanist of the entire Middle Ages.
Nice.
Roger Bacon, 1214 to 1294. This brilliant Englishman is often identified as the first scientist in that he fully embraced Grosseteste's commitment to the experimental method and expanded on it at length. Says that initially Bacon's Franciscan superiors prevented him from publishing, but then Pope Clement IV ordered Bacon to write for him, and Bacon responded by sending the Pope his Opus Majus. It is an amazing work written in only a year of frantic effort. The available modern edition runs 1,996 pages.
In one year.
That's like writing the whole Bible.
Mm.
In it, Bacon displayed knowledge of many different fields: mathematics, the size and position of heavenly bodies, the physiology of eyesight, optics, including refraction, mirrors and lenses, the magnifying glass, the spectacles, an accurate recipe for gunpowder, calendar reform, and on, a veritable library covering all aspects of natural science.
Yeah, it's fantastic. You know, again, it makes me think back to Leonardo. So this is a joke in a sense, but it conveys a serious thought. I mean, these guys were trained in every subject. So the joke about Leonardo was that he was the last guy on earth to know everything. Right?
It
You
sounds like
couldn't.
Roger Bacon knew everything.
Well, that's why I say that reminded me of that. Obviously, they didn't, but the breadth of their studies was so broad. And it also going back to Albertus Magnus, you know, that I'm not a gigantic Harry Potter fan, but I coach kids, and so they're fans of that. It's, you know, the stuff I've seen has been pretty entertaining. But I think the head of that school, whatever the school is where all those kids go, oh, Hogwarts, is like Alberta or Albus or something. And I wonder if she took that name from Albertus Magnus.
Maybe so. Interesting.
So.
He says it later on about Bacon. He says his Opus Magnus was filled with remarkable predictions about future inventions, including microscopes, telescopes, and flying machines.
Well, back to Leonardo again.
Well, when did Leonardo live?
If I'm not mistaken, he was around Columbus around that same time.
Okay. Then Camp Capanus or something like that of Navarra, 1220 to 1296. His greatest contribution came as a sophisticated translator and commentator on two extraordinary works of knowledge. And he translated Euclid's Elements and Ptolemy's Planetary Theory book. And so that gave Europeans access to that stuff. Theodoric of Freiburg, 1250 to 1310. I've been to Freiburg.
Oh, good.
Theodoric was the first to realize that rainbows are caused not by either refraction or reflection, but by both within a single raindrop. Using spherical flasks and glass globes filled with water, he was able to create rainbow effects in his laboratory.
You almost picture these guys, don't you? Like children, not children in their intellectual capacity, but seeking out the answers to like children's questions. You know, like, well, what
Where
caused
does
that
that come
rainbow?
from?
Yeah, how do we get those colors, you know, which, you know, most people today can't answer, and we think we're smarter than these guys. They were geniuses.
Thomas Brand Bradwardine or Bradwardine, 1290 to 1349. He was the leading member of a group known as the Oxford Calculators. Pioneers in formulating and quantifying theorems in kinetics and dynamics. They were the first to formulate the mean speed theorem. So, the now published sources prove to us beyond contention that the main kinematical properties of uniformly accelerated motion still attributed to Galileo by the physics text were discovered and proved by scholars at Merton College back then. So, and then somebody we have all heard of, William Ockham,
Yeah, he stands out.
from 1285 to 1349. He's famous for Ockham's razor.
Which isn't exactly the way we use it today, right?
Right, he goes, Ockham died during the outbreak of the Black Death. I'm not sure if that was his actual cause of death, but that's when he died. Today, Ockham is remembered primarily for his principle known as Ockham's razor, which stresses parsimony in the formulation of explanations. As he expressed it, explanations should not be multiplied beyond necessity. Too often, this is misrepresented as saying one should prefer the simplest explanation. But the simplest might well be an inferior explanation. What Occam meant was that theory should include no more terms and principles than are needed to explain the matter in question.
Very good.
Oh, but it says that his important contribution was not that. It was that he figured out that all those planets, that space was a vacuum. So they didn't need somebody pushing them across the sky. God set them in motion, and now they're just going.
So, okay.
Yeah. Oversimplification there.
Mm-hmm.
John Baradon, 1300-1358, made a pivotal contribution when he introduced the concept we now know as inertia, which explained Occam's insight that things in motion will tend to remain in motion. Nicole Orisme,
mm-hmm.
maybe the French would just call it Orim with the S being silent. The next vital step toward the heliocentric model was taken by the most brilliant and sadly neglected of the scholastic scientists, Nicole Orim, born in Normandy. So he established that the earth turned on its axis, which gave the illusion that the other heavenly bodies circled the earth. He began by noting that the movements we observed of the heavenly bodies would appear exactly the same whether the earth turned or these bodies were circling the earth. So there were no observational data to settle the matter. So.
Yes.
Albert of Saxony, late 1300s. His most important contribution was the textbook Physics, which carefully summarized the work of all his predecessors. Pierre Eiley, 1350 to 1420, he published Image of the World, a widely read work of cosmology that included his calculations that the circumference of the earth was 31,000 instead of the previous 40,000 estimate. He's still off, but he's closer. Nicholas of Cusa, 1401-1464. Based on eclipses, he noted that the earth was smaller than the sun, but larger than the moon. But what of the earth's position? Was it fixed? He observed that whether a man is on the earth or the sun or some other star, it will always seem to him that the position he occupies is the motionless center, and that all the other things are in motion. It followed that humans could not trust their perceptions that the earth was stationary in space. Indeed, according to Nicholas, the earth moved through space. And then we get to Copernicus, finally, 1473 to 1543. So what did Copernicus contribute? He put the sun in the middle of the solar system and had the earth circling it as one of the planets. What gave such special luster to his work was that he expressed it all in mathematics. He worked out the geometry of his system so as to permit the calculations of future positions of the bodies involved, which was essential for setting the dates of Easter, the solstices, and the like. But these calculations were no more accurate than those based on the Ptolemaic system dating from the second century. That is because Copernicus failed to realize that orbits in the solar system are elliptical, not circular. To make his system work, Copernicus had to postulate loops in the orbits of heavenly bodies that accounted for the seeming delays in the completion of those orbits. There was no observational support for his contention. Consequently, everything in Copernicus' famous book on the revolutions of the heavenly spheres is wrong, other than the placement of the sun in the center. And it was nearly a century later that Kepler, the German Protestant, got things right by substituting ellipses for his circles. So,
yeah, everything falls into place.
Yeah, it just shows that, you know, this long 400 year process of them discovering a little bit more and building on previous people's, you know, knowledge. So,
yeah, he didn't come out of nowhere. He did not come out of a vacuum. He was putting together what everybody had been saying up to that point. And he himself was not the final solution. It was Kepler, the German Protestant guy, who put in the ellipses, and then everything falls into place.
Yeah. Well, his conclusion, he always says it better than us. This record of systematic progress explains why the distinguished historian of science, I. Bernard Cohen, noted that the idea that a Copernican revolution in science occurred goes counter to the evidence and is the invention of later historians. Most of Cohen's sophisticated colleagues agree. Copernicus added a small step forward in the long process of normal science, albeit one having immense polemical and philosophical implications. It should be noted, too, that the scholars involved in this long process were not rebel secularists. Not only were they devout Christians, they all were priests or monks, even bishops and cardinals, all of them.
Yeah.
And one more thing, they all were embedded in the great scholastic universities. In fact, 9 of the 13 who preceded Copernicus were faculty at the University of Paris.
Well, and think about this, Hampton, before we read his last paragraph, but as we went through our founding fathers, how many of them were devout Christians?
Yeah, many. I think like of the 55, I think it was 55 signers, almost 50 of them were pastors or something. You know, I mean,
Yeah. So if Christians brought about the great advances of science, and Christians developed, you know, outside of God's return, the benevolent king kind of government that will fully exist on the earth in the future. So they developed the best system until then. Why wouldn't people be more attracted to Christianity if Christianity was the foundational block of great government and great science? Why wouldn't people study that more? And it's because the secularists, not as it's used in that chapter today that we read from Stark, but he was talking about the scholastics, but it's because the secularists rule today, and they've removed God from most of our thinking. They control the social imaginary, but you got to pierce that. But that takes homework.
Well,
right, that's what we're providing is the homework to begin to pierce.
Well, and it's not a battle of facts, it's a spiritual battle.
Ultimately, that's right. You're fighting against, deceptive entities.
So his final little section is faith and reason. The pursuit of knowledge did not suddenly appear in the 17th century. From early days, Christian theologians were devoted to natural philosophy. That provided the fundamental basis for the creation of universities, thus giving an institutional home to science. The Christian thinkers who studied and taught at these universities were responsible for remarkable advances in an era supposedly short on progress. Similarly unappreciated advances were occurring in industry and technology.
So that's where we'll go next. Right. So I wanted to wrap up today with something I listened to yesterday. So because it helps crystallize some of these concepts. But in our culture today, you'll hear, you know, the dominant issue of our day, you know, in the last couple of years has been COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
And within that discussion, you will constantly hear the rejoinder, you know, you need to follow the science.
Right.
You backward Christians need to follow the science. So I have a recommendation for people, and that is to find wherever you can an interview with Richard Fleming. Richard Fleming, I spent a day with him a year and a half ago at Dallas. And it was a conference, but not very many people showed up. And so basically those of us who did show up, they had him to ourselves for the whole day. So I could ask him anything I wanted. And Richard Fleming had his PhD in physics when he was 18 years old. Then he went on to get his medical degree. So he's a nuclear cardiologist. He also has a law degree. So do you think this guy's comfortable within the realms of science? I would say so. Right. So he has provided 54 minutes of documented testimony, you know, it was filmed and recorded so that it could be used in a courtroom. They're trying to bring all these issues surrounding COVID to a court case. And he's provided expert testimony for 54 minutes. If you can find that, I found it on Peter Halligan's Substack. But if you can find that, you need to listen to it. He will clarify the entire thing. It's 20 years of research that took them to build COVID-19. It is not a natural virus. They took a natural virus out of a horseshoe bat, but then they reconstructed it into what they wanted. And what they wanted was a bioweapon. And when he gives you those details, he's not speculating. At one point, he didn't say this on the interview, but I know this from talking to him personally. They asked him to work on the project, and he refused. But he's on the inside of that. He can tell you everything they did to that virus to make it an efficient killer, how they modified the where it attaches to your cell, because the coronavirus that's in a horseshoe bat does not attach to human cell. It wouldn't do anything to you and me. So they modified the attachment site, and he'll tell you how they did that. And he's not speculating. He will show you the research that says what they were doing and why. He traces the money mostly from our government. It's mostly us, a little bit of China, but mostly the good old United States.
Wow.
Desires to kill a huge percentage of the population. I am not making that up, as bizarre as that sounds. COVID-19 is a bioweapon on purpose constructed for its goal of reducing the world's population. And he will go into the vaccines in great detail. Remember, 2 years before COVID-19, so in other words, 2017, there was an adjustment to what's called the EUA, the Emergency Use Agreement for vaccines. Now, why do you think that was adjusted 2 years before this thing hit? It's been 20 years in preparation, and they knew they needed adjustments because they knew they could never produce a vaccine in 1 year.
Yeah.
So they modified all that through government changes so that they could rush out the vaccine, and he will tell you exactly what that vaccine is.
Well, Richard Fleming. So,
Richard Fleming. So that, but my point in bringing that up is that's science. That's real science. What we're told in the public arena is to follow their science, i.e. what they mean is you should be vaccinated. It's science. Well, listen to Richard Fleming, who's eminently qualified to talk on this stuff. He's written over 400 scientific articles published. He sits on numerous medical journal boards. He's used to reading patents and medical journal stuff. He'll tell you exactly what's going on. And he's been fighting it from day one. And it's sworn testimony. And he's not saying anything that he can't defend tooth and nail in a courtroom. And it's overwhelming. So get that and listen to it so that you can pierce the darkness of what's going on.
Sounds interesting. I'll look for it.
Okay, champ.
Okay, well, I will talk to you next time.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Therefore, I exhort you, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a sacrifice, alive, holy, and pleasing to God, which is your reasonable service. Do not be conformed to this present world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may test and approve what is the will of God, what is good and well-pleasing and perfect.